rock and roll.
Good morning. We'll call the meeting to order. This is State Government Finance for Thursday, February 23rd, 2012. We have a quorum. Members, you have before you the minutes from our meeting of February 22nd. Can we have someone move?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move approval of the minutes.
Well, that's what I like to hear.
All right.
Representative Murphy, Representative Murray, it's early yet. Representative Murray moves the minutes. Any additions or corrections?
The donkey had his Wheaties, Mr. Chairman.
Oatmeal.
Breakfast of old cheese.
Yeah. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of those wonderful minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 1975. Representative Benson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I would like to move House File 1975.
We have, of course, the author of the bill, Representative Drazkowski. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 1975 relates to a chapter in statutes, Chapter 16C, that deals with the ability of state government to contract and outsource particular functions as they see need to. The statute itself, two different sections in the chapter relate to limiting the ability of agencies to do outside contracting and require the agency actually first to certify that there aren't any current state employees that are able and available to perform the services, and also limits the ability for the agency to contract if there are people who have been laid off in the history of the in the recent history of the agency prior to them being able to do contracting. So, Mr. Chair, what this does is removes from the two sections in that chapter those limitations which would untie the hands of Governor Dayton's commissioners so that they had the ability to use regular employees and contracts in the mix in a way that they best see fit in order to most efficiently and effectively serve the needs of the citizens of Minnesota.
Members, there's an amendment in the packet. I understand, Representative Winkler, that's your amendment? The A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is. I don't know if you want to take it at the beginning or wait till there's some...
Well, I thought we'd get the...
It's not exactly... I don't know that it's in the form the author wants.
He has indicated he's okay with the amendment.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, members, then I move the A1 amendment. Representative Drazkowski, I'm probably not going to support your bill, but I suspect it's going to pass out of committee. And this is a disclosure provision that just requires that all contractors who contract with the state of Minnesota have to share with the public where the jobs are going to be that they're going to be doing on behalf of the state, whether it'll be in Minnesota, outside of Minnesota, or outside the United States, so that at least we know where our tax dollars are being spent for jobs issues. And so I would urge the committee to adopt the amendment.
Discussion on the A1 amendment. Representative Drazkowski, do you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Winkler and I did have this discussion in the Government Ops Committee. It would simply add one more item under the reporting requirements that that the agencies have to report relative to outside contracting, so that then they are required to then file a report. So it would just become inherently a part of that report. Mr. Chair, support the amendment.
Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The A1 amendment is adopted. So, members, we now have House File 1975 as amended before us. Discussion. If there's no discussion on the committee, we have at least one person who has asked to testify, Mr. Kurt Yoakum.
Thank you.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Kurt Yoakum. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Administration. Just briefly, HF 1975 is not a department initiative, and the department is not as supportive of the legislation going forward. The requirements for contracting in 16C.08 and 16C.09 have not prevented state agencies from bringing a better value in government to Minnesota citizens. To highlight just a few examples, just solely from the Department of Administration, in the last year alone, we've effectively handled lease negotiations that reduced facility lease costs by more than $4.5 million last year, reducing property and casualty insurance, operating expenses ratios below industry standards, and reduced rates and returned an estimated $1.8 million in dividends to state agencies and other entities. And our strategic contracting and purchasing have created savings and cost avoidance of $2.9 million just in the first half of last year alone. Nor have the statutes prevented agencies from seeking innovative solutions from the private sector. As an example, I'd highlight the department's collaboration with General Mills to bring lean and continuous improvement training to several hundred state and local government employees to dramatically reduce the waste and time efficiencies and dramatically improve processes reforms within state functions. Additionally, the state, with employee participation from multiple agencies, and negotiated a master contract for data analytics, which will allow state agencies and local governments to take advantage of private sector innovation from 22 different private sector vendors in 12 service categories. That was a report that we presented to the committee just a short time ago. And finally, just to say that the Department of Administration, the commissioners worked diligently to foster a sense of teamwork and unity of mission at the department as we try to bring even greater value to the services that we provide. The department's own efforts at reform, along with the governor's administration with the Better Government for a Better Minnesota, depend largely on the trust and engagement of state employees. Obviously, this has been a tougher year, the last year has been a tougher year for state employees with the government shutdown, and also the time of change with massive IT consolidation. I think the state employees have handled that with great resilience and dedication to making those work. We do fear, with passage of today's legislation, that might undermine some of the trust of state employees that will depend on putting forward our own reform efforts. That basically concludes my comments. I just want to say I'll gladly stand for questions. I've also brought today the state's chief procurement officer, Kent Allen, if you have any questions on the fiscal notes or technical questions. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Yoakum? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Yoakum, it's been a pretty tough year for all Minnesotans, wouldn't you agree?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, yes, it would.
My question is, if you could show that you could save millions of dollars by opening up 16C so that you could do a better job of making sure that the most efficient, most effective for the taxpayers of Minnesota could be used, would that be something you would approve?
Mr. Yoakum?
You could say, I mean, you gave me a number of... You gave me a number of pretty exciting facts about the money you'd save, but if you could show you could save millions of dollars, would that be something you'd pursue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, we would love to be able to demonstrate that. I think the fiscal note shows at this point that there's a level of uncertainty about what we can show or what we can't show with possible savings.
Representative Benson.
And Mr. Yoakum, have you spent any time with any kind of study about what this might mean?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I think I'll have Mr. Allen correct me if I'm wrong. I do believe that, you know, going forward with some of the data analytics work, that's part of the purpose of in doing some of those contracts is to see where we can have some greater efficiencies out there.
Representative Benson?
So you really don't have any idea how much money this could save the taxpayers of Minnesota, but you're here today to make sure that it doesn't happen. What's the real reason behind it then?
Mr. Yoakum?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I believe I was straightforward in my testimony that I do believe that we've been effective in working under the current constraints, and we do genuinely believe that the engagement and the work with the state employees is fundamental to any success that we have in reform, and I do believe that we could possibly undermine some of that, some of those efforts that we've had with state employees to effectively bring forward some reforms and innovation.
Representative Benson?
Do you see your job as making sure that we are, and you know, I think state employees do a great job, mm-hmm. but one of the things that I have to look out for is all of my constituents, mm-hmm. and many of them are not state employees, and they pay the bills. And not that state employees don't, they do. Don't you think it's incumbent upon you as someone in authority to make sure that we're being as most efficient as possible and allowing for 16C to be opened up so that we could make sure that happens is part of your responsibility?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I believe the Department and the Commissioner of Administration takes very seriously that responsibility of fiscal stewardship and definitely a willingness to look at all options for doing that.
Thank you.
Representative
Kahn. Well, Mr. Chairman, my comment isn't directed to the witness. It's directed to the committee. So if there's anyone else who has something to say to the witness, they should probably go first.
If there's no further question, Mr. Yocum, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1975? No. Seeing that no one does, Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out to something that was done through this committee last year, and I'm glad Representative Downey is back in the room because he deserves most of the credit for doing it. I'll also point out that this was in the governor's State of the State speech. There were only two non-retiring legislators who were complimented for doing something, and that was me and Representative Downey. Of course, two people right behind us said we'd make the body extremely happy if we both made a pact to retire together. But aside from that, negative comment. Aside from that negative comment, the thing that we were given credit for was the, and it's kind of relevant to this because this will help make the information that the state gets much better, was the coordination of the state's information systems into one department. And it was done on a bipartisan basis. I carried the bill, and Downey was a co-author when we were in the majority, and he carried the bill, and I was a co-author when you guys were in the majority, and the chair of the committee put it into his the omnibus appropriations bill for this, which is why it passed in the long run. Now, the critical thing, one of the critical things in passing that bill, because we had to get the administration's support to keep it in that omnibus appropriations bill, and me and the Senate author. Senator Bonoff spent the entire weekend before the special session working and guarding it with Representative Downey saying he totally trusted us and anything we agreed on he'd accept. So, you know, believe it or not, you did say that. And you did in the long run. But anyway, the reason MAPE supported it was that we took the references to 16C, or we left a very limited reference to 16C in the bill. And the reason Representative Downey, and of course now he's here so he can speak for himself, the reason he agreed to it was that he was convinced in looking at the work that we had done on things like data and analytics that we could get outside contract help, that it did not stand in the way when there were not qualified people to do it, and there were not state employees who were being overlooked in order to do that. And, you know, I think that was, you know, I still say, and I give more credit to Representative Downey than to me, but I do say that was the most significant reform that we've done with looking forward to savings of possibly $50 million over the next 10 years or so. And, and you know, maybe even more as we start to be able to do the kind of comparisons that a unified information system will let us do. And so that's why I think this bill is unnecessary. We've been able to do significant reform without getting rid of 16C as we have it. And had we left the reference to 16C in the bill, it would not have been agreed on to the administration and would not have passed. So I suggest we do not, I think we're in the position to get better data now than we have in the past, and I think we're in the position to track contracts better than we have in the past, again, because of the work mainly done by Representative Downey. So I'm going to vote against this bill, and I don't think we should mess around with 16C when it's really working, when the parts that we have in it in cooperation with the administration and in cooperation with the involved unions have been working quite well.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I thank Representative Kahn for those kind words. And my recollection is a little different on some of the particulars, but I'm a big supporter of this bill, and those of you who might remember, I had something quite similar to this, even went a little further in, I think it was House File 192 last year, that would have not only done what is in Representative Drazkowski's bill, which I'm a co-author on, but would also have allowed state bargaining units to actually bid on contracts unencumbered by state overhead, so it would allow them to become value-added service providers, identify places on their own, perhaps even where these opportunities exist, and go ahead and bid as state workers if they, in fact, are the best folks to provide the service and can add more value at a reduced cost by doing it outside the whole complex of the state bureaucracy. So I support this, and I supported it last year, and I'm going to be a strong proponent of this here today, and we'll certainly vote for it. And with regard to some of the comments on the OET consolidation, my original bill actually had OET required to compete for every piece of business that they would get against private sector providers. I realized that was not going to go anywhere, and so I was willing to negotiate that out. And in the end, we worked with MAPE to find a little bit of common ground on the 16C provision, which basically says that right now the state CIO and an agency head, if it's mutually agreeable, can allow that agency to actually go to an outside service provider for the services that OET is currently providing them. So it's not what I would have wanted. This is, I think, much stronger and better, and I do compliment Representative Kahn and Senator Bonoff. That was a dicey negotiation at the end, and there were a couple of provisions where, in the end, we gave the governor and the unions and the other side of the aisle some things that they wanted to at least get started on an important project. So I don't think it quite goes as far as I would like, and this bill does, so I'll be voting for it, and thank Representative Drazkowski for bringing it forward.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn and Downey. I voted against that wonderful reform legislation that you passed last year.
You're wrong once in a while.
Yes, I am Representative Kahn quite often, in fact, but that wasn't one of the times. And for two reasons. Number one, you don't need to pass a very big piece of legislation in order to begin this consolidation because it's actually a very slow and long process to get it done right. And I thought additional legislation wasn't really going to accomplish anything. And second, it's a kind of a classic two-step to first consolidate all IT under one house and then remove the restrictions on contracting out, and pretty soon the entire IT function of state government has been outsourced with no ability to ever bring it back in again. And it's not really a vehicle. I'd call it more of a Deloitte two-step, something like that. An IT two-step. Anyway, so I think it was I'm glad that I voted against that bill, despite the governor's favorable mention of both of you. In fact, I remember in a Pawlenty State of the State address, I was chagrined to be mentioned in a positive way for working with him on something. And I was, it wasn't something I was extremely proud of, actually. But the problem, I think, here is that once you go down the path of outsourcing, and once you have a commissioner or somebody in state government who thinks that it's a good idea to get rid of jobs, get rid of functionality, and start doing contracting work, you're taking on a lot of risk that you don't know how to do what you're doing very well, or that you're not good at managing contracts, and there's nothing in here to provide guardrails for how that outsourcing would be done. And once the functions are gone, it's almost impossible or extremely expensive and difficult to rebuild it and bring it back in-house again. So I think this is not a limitation on the ability of the administration to do outsourcing where it makes sense. It's just a little bit of a protection to make sure that we do it in a smart way and don't go overboard because of the whims of a particular commissioner. These commissioners might or might not have a concern about it. A future commissioner could be corrupt and be in league with an outsourced vendor and be getting kickbacks. We don't know. But if we don't have any restrictions in place to guide some of those decision-making efforts, I think we're really opening ourselves up to a lot of risk. So I would strongly urge a no vote on this. There may be ways that we could amend or modify or improve the statutes that exist, but a wholesale deletion I don't think really does anything good for the state at all.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I guess I'll ask the author of the bill because I don't know the answer. Maybe some of the staff people were. Do we have any restrictions on state law on commissioners or legislators? For example, a legislator who's passed a certain piece of legislation, getting value from that, like insider trading value, you know, equivalent to, do you have anything equivalent to the Stock Act that Congress is working on passing right now? And could a commissioner outsource, I'm not saying that anyone would do this, I'm just saying, do we have anything in law that would stop a commissioner from outsourcing some very lucrative activity and then immediately afterwards taking a position with the firm that he outsourced to? Is there anything in state law that forbids that? And I'm asking that of staff or the author mainly, because it's his bill. So,
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, I'm not familiar with any policy like that we have in statute. And you may want to ask some staff or somebody from admin or somebody about that. But I do know that we do compile a report every year, actually every biennium, on contracting. And I read through the latest one last night, and I still don't. It's got three different chapters to it, and I don't completely understand. But it looks like we contract somewhere between 1 and 3% of the general fund budget equivalent each biennium, and so we're already doing some contracting around, you know, after, even given the severe limitations that are in 16C, we're already doing some contracting. So I would expect if there were problems, we'd have the same exposure currently.
Representative
Kahn. I don't know, 1%. This is supposedly going to increase the amount of contracting from 1% maybe to 10% or something. Or something like that, and the you know, so that's 10 times the amount. And I think we don't need, we've seen on the federal level, we don't need an awfully big percentage to have it be a pretty large chunk of money. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to actually make a proposal. I'm not going to make it as a motion now, but maybe is I would like to lay this bill. I would like to come up with an amendment, because this is going to, according to the author, greatly expand the amount of outside contracting we're doing, and I would like to be able to have an amendment to this bill that specifically, that specifically prohibits or at least tracks something along the line of the Stock Act that Congress seems to be passing almost unanimously, so that we're not going to have a scandal that will result from this committee quickly passing this bill. So that we don't have a way of prohibiting this specifically, that someone who's done an outside contract is connected with an outside contract has been prohibited from working with the group that gets that contact for a specific amount of time. I don't know what you want to do. I don't know if I never doubt Mr. Shepard's ability to respond very quickly. But I don't know if this is something he could do in the next 15 seconds or so. So I think so. But I think that if we're looking, if this bill means anything, it means it's going to be much easier to do outside contracting. And I think as we're looking to the problems in the federal government and in other states and so forth, I think we really want to put some something in place. Certainly better reporting, certainly better oversight, which of course we'll have from the OET consolidation. But I don't know if I want to make that as a motion. We don't seem to have an overwhelming lot to do. It's not like we have the budget, but I think we could not do this for a meeting or so and let the author research the issue and let Mr. Shepherd give us the carefully drafted amendment so that we don't impose on, we don't put great contractions on a part-time legislator.
Mr. Shepherd, can you give us any kind of response to her question or suggestion?
Mr. Chair and members, first of all, I think it is correct that an amendment such as that suggested by Representative Kahn would take more thought than I could produce during a meeting. And Representative Kahn, at the beginning of her statement, asked if there were any laws on the books now, and there is a, for public officials, elected officials, there's a conflict of interest law in Chapter 10A. There's also a code of ethics for state employees in the executive branch. Whether or not those documents or policies that the Commissioner of Administration has for officials engaged in contracting would apply would depend on the facts of a particular case, I think. And so I don't have any generic comment on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Is there any sense in the statute that it would apply at all after the person had left state employment?
Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, as part of the State Employee Code of Ethics, there is a provision that forbids employees in the executive branch from receiving a promise of future employment or other future benefit from a source relating to the duties of the employment. So I think if you had a situation in which somebody allegedly were promised a future job in exchange for guiding a contract to a vendor, that it would depend on the facts of every case, but I think it's arguable that would cover at least some cases.
Representative Gunther.
My question has been answered, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drazkowski, any thoughts about the question that Representative Kahn has raised?
Not any specifically, Mr. Chair. I didn't intend to, or I don't think I did, Representative Kahn, suggest that this was going to, bill was necessarily going to greatly expand, as you mentioned, contracting, but it would certainly untie the hands of state agencies to be able to make those decisions as to what they would want to do. The narrative on the fiscal note from the department doesn't suggest that they expect any greatly expanded contracting. They really didn't know whether they'd be more or the same or less, and I don't think anybody does. So in terms of the volume, Mr. Chair, we have no idea, and it may vary from one commissioner to the next and one biennium to the next. But I think I'm certainly satisfied with what Mr. Shepherd had to say.
Well,
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just thinking about a couple of agencies that do really extremely high volumes of contracting right now, thinking about Department of Transportation, where they let literally millions, billions of contracts every year over in the Department of Human Services, the same. And so while I share some of Representative Kahn's concerns about having the appropriate controls in place, and frankly, the design and the administration of contracts is a different skill set than self-performing the work, granted. But boy, it sure seems to me like we have enough of it going on now in these other areas that this is not new ground, and maybe some language would be helpful down the road. But I personally don't think we need to hold up the bill trying to clear that up at this point and support the bill as it stands.
Further discussion, Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't see, we're hearing two conflicting things. We're hearing we need this because state government is constricted by 16C as it stands, and then we hear, well, it's not going to really make very much of a change, so we don't really have to fix it. Now, I admit I never thought about the issue of legislative internal, acting on inside information until Congressman Waltz brought up the bill and until it got that big attention on the federal level. So I think this is a bill that's coming before us that, if it's important to pass at all, is going to have an effect. It also gives us a chance to make sure that there is at least some reporting and some follow-up on, for the contracting that we are doing. So, I hope we could just have an agreement to lay it over so that we didn't have to have a motion to do it on issues. But, I'm willing to, if we don't have an agreement, then I guess I'll make the motion.
Representative Winkler, to this point.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn, I think you're really onto something. And Representative Downey, you actually triggered something that I think makes this point even stronger, which is that we've had some real problems with contracting at MnDOT and at HHS. In fact, I think Congresswoman Bachman was just here this week talking about some of the issues related to contract work being done and major agreements in place between healthcare organizations and the state. We've had huge amounts of money diverted out of programs at Health and Human Services, basically fraud and theft in the last 6 years. And at MnDOT, the contracting issue is one of the contributing factors to the bridge collapse. And so I think there is no question that when you raise MnDOT and HHS as examples of where contracting is going well, it should cause us to pause and find out if we're going to be expanding contracting significantly in the state or enabling it, whether we have the ethical and other kind of restrictions in place to make sure that it's being done for the right reasons. So I support Representative Kahn.
So.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is on another kind of subtopic. Representative Drazkowski, you know from our discussion in the prior committee hearing that I have a particular interest in lines 2.15 through 2.17 because that's language that I added in 2007. And, of course, I won't take personally your attack on me. Kidding. But in all seriousness, this was a provision that Governor Pawlenty signed into law. It was bipartisan. And the idea here was not to issue a hard mandate, but to say that for a position elimination where there's already a four-year time frame, a seniority unit layoff list, that's something that already exists, and it exists for 4 years when a position has been eliminated. This just says that the agency before outsourcing has to consider the same former employee, not hire them, not give them the work, but consider them. It's maybe a nudge in a direction, but it's certainly not mandatory. Why do you think that we need to get rid of this provision?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simon as well. Representative Simon, this provision is consistent with the other provisions in that section, in that it limits the ability of the commissioner to make those decisions. I'm not familiar with the context around which this provision was passed into law and signed, signed by Governor Pawlenty and passed into law. But I wouldn't expect that he would sign a bill that had that provision in it by itself. So I don't know a lot about what his motivations or the situation was, but this provision is equally limiting as the other parts of that particular section are.
Mr. Chair, I would just say then, this was at the time, and Representative Kahn may have a better memory of the context there. She chaired the committee at the time, but this was something that was put in that was more or less a consensus item. The language is pretty mild. I'm not going to offer an amendment here, but I think this is one of the reasons, apart from my personal involvement in it, that the bill gives me pause. I think it goes too far in accomplishing its aims, and this is, I think, an example of a reasonable, well-tailored provision that gives consideration to, but no more than that, people whose jobs have been eliminated for a period of time on an existing list. And I don't think it's too much to ask that we would at least give them a crack at doing the job that they once did.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, I hope that we could do it in a kinder and gentler manner, but I guess at this point I would make the motion to lay the bill on the table for the purpose of coming up with an amendment that will look at the ethical dilemma it may place us into. I know we don't usually do things for specific reasons, but I think in this case, I think it's appropriate for a specific reason, so that the so that we're not really looking into the entire bill all over again. And I guess I'll ask for a roll call vote.
Representative Kahn, this bill needs to be sent to Ways and Means.
I think this committee's a lot better than Ways and Means. The chair is particularly terrific in this committee. Sorry, that's inappropriate comment.
Because it does need to go to Ways and Means, that would give you or anyone else an opportunity to craft an amendment that could be considered there. You know, if this were going straight to the floor, my tendency would be to lay this over for a bit to see what kind of amendment is drafted so we could have a full discussion about it. But, in fact, this could now happen, give you an opportunity or anybody else to do this at Ways and Means.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe Ways and Means is very strict rule saying that we only look at fiscal issues. And I'm not sure that this ethical moral issue is really a fiscal issue. And as I said, I have more faith in this committee doing a good job than, you know, Ways and Means. We've spent a lot more time looking at these things, and I just think we'll do a better job. And, you know, again, I would not make this motion if this were the last day of the session or if we had, you know, the whole budget bill to get out before us. I do think we have time. I think Mr. Representative Jaskowski can work with Mr. Shepard and come up with some reasonable language, and I think it will turn a questionable bill into a very good bill that might get bipartisan support.
Well, Representative Kahn, given what your interest in considering an amendment, I will lay this bill over and expect to bring this back as soon as possible.
Okay.
Give you an opportunity to put together an amendment if you wish to do that so we can consider it. We do have some time here. It doesn't have to be absolutely done today. So I will lay the bill over and we'll come back to this as soon as we can.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Draskowski. We'll now take the second bill.
Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1976.
Representative Weiger moves
sure where it goes.
House File 1976, and see, this needs to go.
When you look at the data from Congress, it's just shocking.
This would go to the floor. That it be recommended to pass.
And I recommend it pass and move to the floor.
Totally okay. Incompetent.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 1976 is a bill that requires e-verify to be implemented by state agencies for all new hires in the legislative, executive, and judicial branches in state government. A little bit of history, members. Governor Pawlenty had an executive order that required e-verify to be implemented not only for state contracts over $50,000, but also for state agency hires similar to what this bill aims to accomplish. Governor Dayton rescinded that executive order upon taking office, and then this committee, I believe, was involved with the legislature during the budget resolution in July in bringing back, in writing into law with in cooperation with the governor, the contracting provisions. So, Mr. Chair, what this bill would do is add back E-Verify for all new state hires in the legislative, executive, and judicial branches.
Discussion.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I do recall, and you know, perhaps the author knows it better than I do, but I do recall we had a legislative auditor's report that was very negative about E-Verify, and I'm not sure that, and has the author followed up on that, and does he know that those questions have been resolved with, and has the legislative auditor looked at it again?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn, yes, Representative Kahn, actually there are two different reports that the legislative auditor had. One focused on, back during Governor Pawlenty's administration, the outside contracting, E-Verify. There was an outside contractor actually that was hired to do the E-Verify, and there was questions around that. That was the negative one probably that you read or remember, and I understand that that was subsequently resolved. There was also another one that looked at some of the state government E-Verify components, and I do remember that was a 2009 report, and at that point it acknowledged that the agencies hadn't moved as quickly as the legislative auditor had expected, I remember reading about the fact they had made it through 1 point of the 3 points of their implementation plan, so that's what I remember about that, Representative Kahn. But in that second audit, I don't remember any particular glaring problems they were referencing.
Representative Simon.
I'm sorry, I didn't know when.
Just one thing. One other question. Is the commissioner refers to the commissioner of finance?
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, I would defer if I could to Mr. Shepard if he's able to help us out.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the commissioner on line 8 of the bill is the commissioner of management and budget.
Okay.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, is there any, does that commissioner really have jurisdiction over the legislative and judicial branches? I thought we had some separation of powers. And I know the courts, you know, the legislature may kind of roll over sometimes, but I think the courts are awfully careful of that. So,
Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, I missed the very beginning of Representative Kahn's remarks, but I think if the reference is to the sentence that begins on line 8 about the commissioner overseeing training, that is for executive branch appointing authorities.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, how is it then taken care of in the legislative and judicial branches? And do we have a fiscal note on how they're going to deal with that?
Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair, members, that might be a question for the author. As I understand the bill right now, the appointing authorities in the legislative and judicial branch would, if they desired, implement their own training and audits for their E-Verify applications.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Drazkowski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn, I specified in the bill the training for the executive branch, because that was the largest one. Certainly, the other two branches are more nimble. E-Verify is carried out in private workplaces, even to the extent where employees are told, HR employees are told to go through an online tutorial on their own. And so, I would expect those two branches, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, would be able to provide the oversight without any direction from the legislature.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, actually, if you read your fiscal note, it does say that. So, what about just making this then only apply to the executive branch? if that's the place where we need it.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, the intent is to have it apply to new hires in all three branches. The intent is to capture all three branches.
Representative Simon, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, the big issue in this debate has been, at least over the last couple of years, the issue of accuracy. I think E-Verify has some real potential, obviously, but you know, we've heard reports, and I'm sure you've addressed this before, but about up to 20% inaccuracy. That's really big. I mean, 2% would be probably pretty big when in an employment context. How can you assure us today about the accuracy of E-Verify? Why won't we get kind of some of the false negatives that we've seen in other parts of the country? Because 20% is a big deal, but even 2 or 3 or 4% is probably too much in this context.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon. Representative Simon and members, there should be a handout. I assume it's in people's packets. It's a 4-page handout. It says E-Verify and probably 16 or 14 point type on the top. And you will see in there that on page 2, I believe, it talks about the accuracy and those false negatives, Representative Simon, in the research that was conducted to pull this together, suggests it's about 0.3%. And I saw some older numbers, too, Representative Simon, that at that point, about 5 years ago, or maybe it was 4 years ago, that number was significantly larger. So this technology has been improving over time. The Department of Homeland Security and Social Security Administration continue to make improvements to that, and that number continues to narrow. So a very insignificant number at this point that are false negatives.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski. I was just wondering who put together this handout that you just referenced.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was put together by our House GOP staff.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, I'm looking at this handout. I guess it would be on page 2, bottom half of the page, the bullet point. It says that it is true that non-citizens and legally permitted resident aliens have a higher than average failure rate. So I take that to mean, and I'm hoping you can confirm or correct me, that of this 1.7%, more of them are, or a disproportionate number of them are legal immigrants who are permitted to work but are still denied. Is that how you take that bullet, what that bullet point means?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler. Yes, that's what I take that to mean, and I would anticipate that that's probably a function of some of the identification requirements for temporary and permanent residents, I would expect, versus you know, citizens who you know, have you know, a more ubiquitous, if you will, or more I don't know what the word is I'm looking for here, Mr. Chair, but I would expect it's a function of the type of identification that is used in those situations.
Well, Mr.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I mean, it seems to me that what you're really trying to get to with E-Verify is separating out people who are legally permitted to work from people who are not permitted to work according to law. And if the flaws in the system are heavily focused on people who are permitted to work but immigrants, then it seems like we're really creating some significant problems, because you know, if you talk to business people, you know, right after tort reform, their top priority, that's sarcastic, one of their top priorities is getting qualified workers, and most people in the business community are looking for the ability to bring in more legal workers, to have people come to this country with talent, skill, ability, or who might be here already, to be able to work. The company I work for, there are a number of PhDs that are immigrants who are permitted to work here legally. My wife, at one point before she became a citizen, was had a green card and was permitted to work as a lawyer. The previous company I worked for, we had a number of software engineers who were extremely good, who were not U.S. citizens, but were permitted to work. And if you're mandating E-Verify in these contexts, what I'm afraid you're doing is denying the skills, abilities, and resources that a lot of immigrants or people who are here on a green card status who could work and work legally, and you're going to create a barrier or a false negative for them, or a false positive, depending on how you look at it, I guess, for their legal right to work. And it seems like we're really denying ourselves some talent that's needed. And at the last committee stop, you didn't really address the question of how people go about getting the data corrected, how they go about appealing, and there's no provision in your bill for appealing or correcting the data or anything else. And you basically said, well, I trust the government will get it right, which, you know, I don't share your trust in government agencies, I guess. But I think we need more in this bill, or you need a greater explanation, because this is really concerning that the very people we're trying to separate and distinguish between are the ones most often caught in the errors in the system, and there's no provision for fixing that. So how do we improve that?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler, I want to thank you for invoking right to work.
What?
You use the words right to work, and I was trying to be funny, Representative Winkler. Oh. I guess it didn't work. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, maybe we can get back to the question of correcting data and appealing.
A latent response. Okay.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Winkler, I don't believe the system is focused on any particular group. As you began your discussion, Representative Winkler, I think the system is designed around the federal government has designed this system to use a variety of different identifications. I've got the sheet here somewhere that has three different columns or categories that the federal government uses in bringing forward. They've got a list A, a list B, and a list C, and you need to provide one item in list A an item in list B and list C. And I don't know, I can pass this around if you're interested, but part of the context of my response here is, Representative Winkler, that E-Verify has within it, and I have done some additional research since we talked last in the last committee stop, has within it the process for making certain that the integrity around some of the due process concerns that the ACLU brought up last time are all covered through the federal process. There's an entire publication written on that the people implementing E-Verify within the agency will follow, and they've got their I's dotted and their T's crossed. And Representative Winkler, I share with you one thing in common. My wife also has a green card, and she supports this bill greatly.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, I Representative Drazkowski, you've said that there is a process, but I'm curious to know what an individual has to do in order to get the data corrected, because if it's wrong, this is an example. My wife, every time she flew into the country from outside, and she'd been a permanent resident of the United States for 6 years, every single time she came in, she got flagged in the system and had to go off to a special room at the airport and have her status reviewed carefully, and it would be, you know, a couple of hours. So we've got two kids on a long international flight. We come in, we go over there 2 hours. Every single time they go through the whole thing, they say, oh, we're sorry. Yes, this all checks out. Here's what you need to do to correct the information. And every single time you do it, nothing happens. Next flight comes in, you're sitting there for another three hours. And my experience with immigration data is it's flawed, and it's very hard to correct. So I know there's a pamphlet or a book, there's an agency, a federal agency, they're the ones who are really creating the problem. So could you describe for us or give us some comfort that people who have data that's inaccurately flagged would be able to somehow correct that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler. Representative, I can hand this document to you if you like. It's 20 pages. It's from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. And on page 12, it talks about tentative non-confirmations. And that's that first group of, if you remember from page 2 of the E-Verify handout, it was 98.3% are confirmed initially. The 1.7% are referred to as tentative non-confirmations. And then, Representative, there's a process that they go through here. It talks about what should I do if an employee receives a Social Security Administrator tentative non-confirmation case result, and then there is a list of you need to notify the employee and go through 9 different steps. What do I do if an employee decides to contest a Social Security Administrative tentative non-confirmation? And there is a list, and there are 8 different steps. How long does it take to process a tentative non-confirmation? It's got some guidelines around that. What should I do during the time an employee is contesting a tentative non-confirmation? Directs the employer to make certain that they act properly. What should I do if there is no update in e-verifying the employee status after 10 federal government work days? There's a process there. How should I resolve a tentative non-confirmation when an employee chooses not to contest, directing the employer again properly according to the law? How should a case be resolved if an employer receives a DHS no-show result but later a letter that indicated their employment authorized from DHS? And how should I close a tentative non-confirmation case? How should a company close a final non-confirmation case? If the employee does not contest a tentative non-confirmation, am I required to terminate him or her? And there is a description around that. How do I notify DHS if I continue to employ an individual after receiving a final non-confirmation? How do I know if the employee contacted the appropriate agency to contest a tentative non-confirmation? I just discovered that I entered some of my employees' information incorrectly when I created the case in E-Verify. The case has already received a result. What should I do? Offers the phone number to call. And then there's a similar list, Representative Winkler, for employee responsibilities and similar details, references, and resources for them as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, you better have a major problem in state government hiring people who aren't qualified to work in order to subject us to that morass of regulation and steps and process that needs to take place. And if you're an average person who's trying to apply for a job and an average employer or an average agency that's dealing with it, if it doesn't work the first time, even if it's false, it's probably just going to result in people not doing it. It doesn't work very well, and there's no reason to impose a system that doesn't work very well when people need to find jobs and we need to have talented people doing them.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Drazkowski. We just kind of seen a whole bunch of crazy bills this year, and I serve on Commerce, and one of those bills that we sent from here, the rule, no rulemaking bill for 2 years, we passed out of Commerce yesterday, continues to shut down the hunting season, so we're not going to have a hunting season for the next couple of years, and not that we need that in Minnesota, and so, and then all the insurance things. So we've seen a bunch of crazy bills, and then this last one you had earlier today that I came in a little late for, to send the jobs to China bill. That's great. That's really nice. Good work. But so on the positive side, I actually want to say that I'm not too threatened by this bill. So we went through E-Verify at my company that I work for. There's quite a few immigrants that work with me in various, obviously they're documented, I guess, and whatever. I don't know the legal term, so I want to be careful how I say it. But they're all still working with me, and I haven't noticed any big problems. So I guess to try to be positive on one bill, I guess I don't see a big problem with this E-Verify myself.
Representative
Murphy. Despite all the other crazy bills that you're doing.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski. I had it sounded out when I started. I'm sorry. At the last committee meeting or at any of the committee meetings, did the legislative auditor testify?
Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, no, they did not.
And was the auditor's report available? Has anything but passing mention of the auditor's report been more thorough than passing conversation about the auditor's report? Has that been part of the discussion?
Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. The Government Ops Committee suggested and talked about the auditor's report, and I did read it. There was actually, for the experience that the government agencies had, was actually a positive. They overall, on the balance, it was a positive process that was not too cumbersome for them. But that report, of course, is online. I read it last night, and certainly could get a copy to you if you like. Again, implementing this part of the Governor Pawlenty's order back in 2008-2009 did not seem to be problematic for the government.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to some of the things that Representative Winkler said and referring to this, the information sheet. To me, E-Verify does exactly what it's supposed to do, and it looks at that population that is questionable on whether they qualify to work in the United States. And when they talk about, you know, it is true that non-citizens and legally permitted resident aliens have a higher than average failure rate, they're talking about, it pops out on the E-Verify computer that there's a disconnect. And that is the population that we do want to look at, make sure that they verify that, in fact, that those people are permitted to work in the U.S. And there's procedures that you use that you can do instantaneously to then correct and verify that information. Now, we got to remember that currently we have to do this on the I-9. You know, everybody that works in the U.S. has to fill out an I-9, and that has to get processed. It's the same. All E-Verify is doing that same work that the I-9 does, but we do it electronically. Gosh, we're in the computer age. Keep hearing these ads. There's one running right now about this guy that's on a typewriter, and he says, "Oh yeah, we just upgraded from Carrier Pigeon." Well, that's what we're talking about here. We're moving to electronic systems that will do the job of the I-9 far better, and will do it instantaneously. And the rate that we're getting is quite high, 98.3%. We're only getting a 0.3% failure rate. So all we, or I shouldn't call that a failure rate. I should call it a mismatch rate, I think, is what they call it. So remember, employment is people travel. I mean, we are a mobile society. We go from state to state. So this is a national system. This is something that if people come in to this state from outside of the state, it's something that we can verify quite rapidly. So I just wanted to talk to those points. This is a good system. This is where we're going with a lot of our documents. So, and lastly, let me just ask the one question: Where did you if I might, Mr. Chairman, where did you find that information about what you do when you find a mismatch? Is that on the website? Is that on the E-Verify website? I believe it is.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Leidiger. It's on the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services website, which is it's got all the E-Verify procedures included in it.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start with a comment. Representative Winkler, I think I heard you say don't trust government agencies. And maybe that will help you when we bring 1975 back, make a different vote on that bill regarding contracting some things. But to the question with, I know this might be hard for you to do, but there is some information contained in the four-page sheet about how the president is in favor of E-Verify, and I know that you don't always agree with some of the things that comes out of Washington, but can you speak to both how this is a national effort, and not only from government, but the national chamber?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Benson. Representative Benson, not only has President Obama provided for or recommended in the, I think it was the 2012 federal budget, additional allocations for E-Verify, but Janet Napolitano implemented it when she was in Arizona and has implemented it with the federal government as well. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is supporting a national E-Verify effort, and they very much endorse it and are working with, Lamar Smith in bringing that particular measure forward through the Congress.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Drazkowski. Two questions, one on your four-page sheet where you say currently four states have laws or executive orders in place requiring the use of E-Verify. Could you tell us what those 14 states are? And then the qualifying phrase at the end, or in some cases for all employees. How many of those states just have it for state contractors, state and state employees, I guess, is what we don't... Does all employees mean even employees who are not being hired by the state? So I guess I'd like to know, of the 14, I guess forget the all employees. I guess we're just looking at the state contractors and state employees. How many?
Representative Drazkowski.
What states are they?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn. Actually, Representative Kahn, the list I had was maybe actually more recent. I had 16 or 17 or 18 states. It was more than that. I have the list in front of me. Would you like me to go state by state? They have different mixes in each state. Some states will require it of the private sector as well. Some will only require contracts in state government. Some will require only state employees. Some will include state contracts and state employees or some other mix. So I would believe that 14 probably, I'm not going to speculate, but the number is somewhere between 14 and 18.
Well, why don't you give us the names of the states that are doing something with this, and let's not look at the division at the moment of different things that they're doing. I imagine it's an awful lot easier for a contractor than for an employee. So I guess I'd like anything that includes, any state that includes state employees with the limits of your bill.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn. And Representative Kahn and members, the list I have is updated as of October 20th of last year. Alabama, Arizona, California, Colorado, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Louisiana, Michigan. Minnesota is on the list because we've got partial. Mississippi, Missouri, Nebraska, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Tennessee, Utah, and Virginia. Those are the ones that are on the list. That's more than 18, I would expect, but the 18 are within that list.
Okay, I guess I didn't at least hearing that see any real clear pattern. But again, looking at the language in the bill, how do you define newly hired employees? Isn't there some better language we could use? Does that mean a year or, you know, a month, a week? What? What does newly hired mean?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn. Representative, it does. There's not a definition included here, but I would define newly hired employees as people who were recently hired after a position announcement was issued and a hiring process was conducted.
So, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, could we have something that put that language in? Because it says you must use it for all newly hired employees. To my mind, that could just mean we would have had to use it for all of the legislative staff people that we brought on at the beginning of this session. Because those are all certainly, I would say, a newly hired employee in the legislative branch. Whoa. So can we have some language that I imagine we'd have to use it for our pages and for everything.
Mr. Chair?
And for everything else, and I think saying exactly what you mean would be helpful.
Representative Drazkowski?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, that's exactly what it means, newly hired employees in the executive, judicial, and legislative branch. It would include those folks that you mentioned as they respond to position announcements and the ability to be employed and go through an employment process with the government. It takes about anywhere from 4 to 10 minutes to input this information for the HR folks, and they receive a result after they push send within about 5 seconds.
Okay.
Mr. Shepherd, if this were to become law, what would be the effective date of this?
You can get her pretty
easy. August.
Mr. Chair, the effective date would be August 1st of 2012, unless this were included in a bill that had an appropriation in it, in which case it would be July 1, 2012.
So it would only apply to new hires after those dates?
Well, that doesn't...
I just wanted a clarification, Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, I agree with that.
Okay.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that would... then maybe we should put that language in for all newly hired employees after the effective date of this act, because I think if you were hired this year, some person could consider that you were a newly hired employee. Some people consider legislators who were elected in the last election newly elected representatives. Certainly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn. I would have to look again, Representative Kahn, but I believe there's a time limit within the E-Verify process. They really prescribe the window of time in which you are supposed to conduct this. So if somebody is on staff for, 3 months, I would expect they don't fall within that window of E-Verify and they no longer inherently within the process are considered a new employee. I would have to review that, though, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn, members, we need to get to see if there's testimony on this bill. I have two more people on the list. Representative Kahn.
Well, okay, but I think then, for example, it should at least say that for all newly hired employees hired within the implementation time frame of the E-Verify Act, if that's what you mean. I mean, I don't like to do these things on the fly. But newly hired, I find, is very... not very good statutory language.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, I wanted to ask Representative Drazkowski, President Obama's allocation to E-Verify, is that for implementation or is that to actually get the system to work?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Green, I am not certain. I would have to do further research into that, Representative. Sorry.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just comments, perhaps to the committee and Representative Drazkowski. I mean, thanks for bringing this bill. Sometimes we overcomplicate things. So I'm going to put on my small business owner hat and say, I hired three guys this week. I'm going to go to the office tomorrow morning
and I'm going to do paperwork, and we're going to fill out I-9 forms for three guys who are going to show up, and I hope that they bring their driver's license and a birth certificate or, you know, proper identification so that I can have all of my documentation in place. I welcome a tool like this as an employer. We should welcome this kind of ease of use as an employer, and we're one of the biggest employers, you know, in our state. So it's a great tool for us to use, and I support the legislation, and we sometimes focus on such microscopic, really specific scenarios, and I think sometimes we overlook the overall good. So I'll be supporting this bill.
Representative Leidiger, and then we're going to see you.
Well,
this morning.
Just a comment and an observation. Representative Green wanted to know, you know, is this used for implementation or is it used for other purposes? There are advertisements that are on the radio and on the TV. It comes out of a federal budget to promote E-Verify. And I suspect that just about everybody in this room has probably heard it once or twice or more. So they're advertising, and they're not only advertising in this state. I understand that the ad buy is nationwide. They're promoting this to all businesses, and businesses are using this, just like Representative Stensrud's business. And many of my constituents who own their businesses and some of the largest companies in the state are using E-Verify. It's being adopted. It's this adoption that takes time. It takes, you know, we've got to familiarize people. And it's an easy tool. And the great thing about it is it's instantaneous verification and of the information that we have and that an employer gets from the I-9. So, but back to the advertising, so it's clear that there is money being spent to promote the system as opposed to just, you know, operating it. And it's clear because we hear these ads.
At this point, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1976? I understand Carolyn Jackson. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. The ACLU of Minnesota is a nonprofit organization with over 8,500 members statewide, and we protect and defend the Bill of Rights. This bill raises questions of due process. Now, Representative Druskowski went through the long list of ways in which an employer can clean up a tentative non-confirmation. Our concern is that, especially, and this would apply to the state government, but if it were to apply to a small business, most small businesses do not have HR departments. So if you get a tentative non-confirmation report, chances are you're not going to take the time to go through that long, long list. You just won't hire the person. And the concern is that if I am going in for a job interview, I'm qualified, I meet it. My potential employer, they want to hire me, we have an agreement, they run an E-Verify report, there's a tentative non-confirmation. I don't know. By law, they're supposed to tell me that there was this report came back. But not always does that happen. And the fact that I may never get notice that there's an error in the system is our chief concern. I pulled a report from the National Conference of State Legislatures done in November 2011, and they list a lot of statistics, a different set of numbers than what was testified here today, but I want to just read this because it does raise concerns about the errors in the system. A December 2010 Government Accounting Office report found that USCIS, and that's who runs the database, has improved the accuracy of E-Verify, immediately confirming 97.4% of 8.2 million new hires in 2009, up from 92% in 2007. The report notes that E-Verify remains vulnerable to identity theft and employer fraud. Name mismatches, multiple or hyphenated names, can still lead to tentative non-confirmation notices. They say the name of the report was Employment Verification. Federal agencies have taken steps to improve E-Verify, but significant challenges remain. An independent study showed that the error rate was too high for it to become a mandated program. The Social Security Administration estimated that 4.1%, or 17.8 million records, contained discrepancies related to name, date of birth, or citizenship status. 12.7 million of these pertain to U.S. citizens. 96.9% of employees attesting to be U.S. citizens were automatically confirmed as authorized to work instantly or within 24 hours. Only 72% of lawful permanent residents and 63% of immigrants authorized to work were confirmed automatically. So this is a system with errors. This report also says that when North Dakota looked at this, instead of passing E-Verify, they directed the legislative management to study the feasibility and require and desirability of requiring private or public employers to use the E-Verify program. And that was passed last year, and the report's not out yet, at least not as the time that this was published. The concern is raised by a private industry saying, I think most employers really want to be in compliance with the law. But if we're going to end up firing people because of inaccuracies in the data, that's a problem. If you dismiss someone who is here legally, you're liable for wrongful termination. It's a sticky question. And I pose before the committee that this is a system with a significant amount of errors in it. And, you know, I just think it raises more complications than it solves. Thank you.
Questions for the testifier, Representative Benson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, this is a question for Ms. Jackson. Has the ACLU raised any concerns or filed any court actions nationally with the policy?
There was a lawsuit, Mr. Chairman, excuse me. There was a lawsuit, I believe, in 2006 looking at the errors in the Social Security Administration database, and they found significant errors, and that was the prompting for the work that's been done to try and improve the accuracy rate. So, yes, we have sued on this.
Representative Benson?
Anything in particular, though, as far as E-Verify, specifically E-Verify is violating somebody's rights?
Ms. Jackson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I didn't work for the ACLU in 2006, but it's been an ongoing system, and I've got a seven-page testimony that was given before Congress, and I'll give it to you after this, that raises the ACLU concerns. Specifically, is there a lawsuit right now on E-Verify? No, there is not. But this lawsuit that I spoke of was what prompted the beginning of the study of looking at this database because it would be used to test verification to work, and it raised tremendous questions of error.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Jackson, do you know about the error rates for the I-9 results as compared to the error rates on E-Verify?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Representative Jackson. Leidiger, I'm not an immigration attorney or an employment attorney. I don't know how the I-9 works. What I'm talking about are errors in a database, and that's our concern. I'm completely familiar with that.
Mr. Chairman, are you aware that the processing of the I-9 and the E-Verify use the same databases?
Ms. Jackson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe I just said I don't know how the I-9 works.
All right.
Representative Leidiger?
You have obviously applied for a job before. And did you have to fill out I-9 papers when you got the job for the ACLU, for instance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger, yes, I had a copy. I have my Social Security card and my driver's license. I handed it to my employer, and they filled it out. I don't know what happened behind the scenes. I'm not an employment attorney. I'm not an HR professional.
Well, what I want,
Representative Leidiger.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I want to drive to this one point, because we talk about a lot of your objection to this is about the errors. So let me just ask you this question. Who's burdened here when it comes to the employer-employee relationship, when it comes to providing the accurate information? Is it the employee's burden to get that job or the employer's burden to process to get that information correct?
Ms. Jackson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger, once again, I will say I'm not an employment attorney. My understanding with E-Verify is that it prevents people who want to work together from doing so because of an error in a federal database. Now, the details of that, you'll have to ask an employment attorney. I simply don't know.
Representative Leidiger?
Well, the purpose of E-Verify is to screen people, to screen out people that have problems in their eligibility to work in the United States. So it's doing its job. It's doing what it's supposed to do. It kicks out people that are questionable. And the burden then rests with the person who wants the job to ensure that the information is accurate. And it has all these tools in there to help that person provide the accurate information. Now, if a potential employee cannot do that, then it means they're not eligible to work in the United States. So it does its job. The system does its job. We sometimes lose the whole idea of the purpose of this thing. It is supposed to kick out people that cannot prove that they are eligible to work in the United States. That's what it's supposed to do. And what it sounds like to me is that you're against this system doing what it is supposed to do.
Ms. Jackson, and then we need to
move on. Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm against the errors in the system, and that's going to be my answer.
Representative Winkler, and then we need to move on to other testifiers.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, I just would urge you to study the Constitution, specifically the requirement of due process of law in order to deny somebody of life, liberty, or property. And among the liberty interests that people have is the ability to pursue employment. And if you are legally permitted to work and a system prevents you from getting work because it is an error, it is not your job to prove the government wrong. It's the other way around.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Mr. Gerber, Ben Gerber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're here to testify today in opposition to this bill. The Minnesota Chamber wholeheartedly believes that immigration law is within the exclusive purview of the federal government. The U.S. Chamber worked with United States Congressman Lamar Smith and United States Senator Grassley, just to mention, Senator Marco Rubio from Florida also signed on to Senate File 1196, and House Lamar Smith's bill is House H.R. 2885. The key to the agreement between the U.S. Chamber and Representative Smith and Senator Grassley was strong preemption language in the bills against state and local laws using E-Verify for establishing state or local employment. Federal immigration is important to maintaining a strong and productive workforce in this country. The Minnesota Chamber, along with the U.S. Chamber, believe that immigration law and E-Verify should not become products of state law that will leave us with a patchwork of various immigration policies across the country. It is important to note that the federal government has not made much progress on federal immigration reform except this one issue. This is the one issue where, as you heard from some of the representatives before, that even President Obama is in favor of. So it is our position that we should let the federal legislation play out, and we oppose this attempt for a state immigration policy.
Questions for the testifier, Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, now you represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. How do you, the U.S. Chamber fully supports this. They're fully behind this. They want this to happen. How do you resolve your differences?
Mr. Gerber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Leidiger, the linchpin of the agreement with the U.S. Chamber and the federal government was the preemption of these state of the state and local laws that regulate immigration. This is a federal issue, and if we result with different states having a patchwork of different laws and regulations over immigration, it's really going to hurt business across the country, and that's what the state chamber is worried about. And the U.S. chamber, if you read, there's a June 14th, 2001, the U.S. chamber had a press release on this, and included in this is the language that the E-Verify bill has strong preemption language for state and local laws. So this is something that the federal government is already working out. And the reason why the U.S. Chamber is on board is because laws like this would be preempted.
Representative Leidiger.
Can you answer why there's promotion of this going on? Promotion of the use of the E-Verify system?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure, Representative Leidiger, what your question is.
Well,
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're hearing ads. We know that the federal government is trying to get people to use it, companies to use it. This is being supported by the National Chamber of Commerce. I'm trying to see what you think about that,
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, this is being supported by the National Chamber, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for the specific reason that we believe you need one immigration solution, one federal regulation on this issue, and not a various patchwork of state regulations as this would be. This is if different states, which we see now, Arizona has a law, all these different states have a law, that impacts businesses as they when they're trying to comply in different states. So we are supportive of E-Verify from a federal legislative standpoint, not from a state standpoint, and that's why the Minnesota Chamber objects to this bill.
And just one last question.
Representative Leidiger.
The implementation of this is this, in your mind, just the use of a website? I mean, the implementation of the system is the promoting of using a website. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, I disagree that it's just the use of the website. It is in practice, but it's forcing certain businesses or certain sectors of the economy to use it and not others. And across the nation, we need one unified solution. And that's why, you know, if you're going to believe that this federal program works, then you should believe in the federal government to implement it through the process that's going on right now in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. And that's why we're saying wait for the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate to resolve this issue instead of passing a state regulation over this immigration, this part of immigration.
Members, we need to bring this to a close. I have two members. Can you make it brief, please? Representative Banyan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will. Mr. Gerber, does House File 1976 place any burden on any member of the chamber?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, this would only apply to state employees. But what our position is that
it's, I know what your position
yeah,
is. I just wanted to be sure I had said that there is no impact on any member of the chamber. That's correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, yeah, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Downey.
Yes, that was my question.
Mr. Gerber, I understand and appreciate very much the chamber, National Chamber, U.S. Chamber's position. This would be best solved at a national level. The problem is the states have been waiting forever for the federal government to solve the problem, and they aren't. And that's why I think we have to, if the federal government isn't going to act, then we have to act. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? If not, Representative Leidiger, do you want to renew your motion?
So moved.
And the motion would be
motion is to recommend pass this bill and move it to the floor.
Okay. To the General Register. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, there is a fiscal note. It doesn't need to go through Ways and Means.
The note says that they are assuming the cost. They're absorbing the cost. Okay. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. The bill is passed, and we'll move on to the general floor. Members, on Tuesday, we will have a presentation from the Secretary of State on a full book laptop scanner system related to voting process. We'll also have House File 1813, Representative Benson's bill. And members, we will take up again House File 1975. And so if there is to be an amendment for us to consider, we ask that that amendment be given to staff by noon on Monday. With that, members, we stand adjourned.